Welcome to Assembly Line, the podcast for entrepreneurs building on the Salesforce platform. We'll go behind the scenes with innovative founders and leaders to share their stories, strategies, and lessons to accelerate your own path to success as a Salesforce ISV. Are you looking to connect with the most dedicated founders and builders in the Salesforce ecosystem? The Assembly Line audience is made up of the exact ISV partners and entrepreneurs you're trying to reach. We're opening up a few sponsorship slots to partner with brands that can truly help our listeners succeed. If you're ready to connect with the leaders of the App Exchange, you can learn more at assemblyline.com/sponsor. That's assemblyline.com/sponsor. All right, so I'm very excited today for another episode of Assembly Line because I'm joined by Adam Zuckerman of Omnitoria. Welcome to the show, Adam.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so this is going to be a great conversation. So Adam has been working in the Salesforce ecosystem for a very long time. He goes back to 2010, and we were just chatting about how we actually got a pretty similar background here. So Adam's run the gamut in terms of acting as an SI partner, now obviously with Omnitoria, an ISV partner. He's even done a little bit of PDO work in the past. So I'm looking forward to getting into the meat of the talk today. So let's just jump right in. Tell us a little bit about Omnitoria, what you guys have built, and how you came up with the idea.
So Omnitoria has built a product called Declarative Webhooks. Kind of as its name suggests, it's essentially a no-code integration platform that's native to Salesforce. It handles both like outbound and inbound integrations. It includes things like, you know, more advanced features like logging, retry, you know, call out sequence, sort of everything that you would expect from, you know, a fully functional like integration platform.
That's great. And so this is actually, I think that anyone who's built on the platform integrations, which these days is pretty much everybody, understands like what a big important aspect this is. I'm honestly sometimes surprised that Salesforce hasn't done more to support webhooks natively. But so many folks have built out, I think, an Apex class that supports the RESTful protocol so that it can be called through an API and kind of a DIY webhook framework. So it's great to see what you guys are building because I think it's very needed. You know, did this come out of your consulting projects and there were folks that needed this and then eventually you realized it had generic applications, or did it just come to you in a stroke of inspiration?
No, I mean, it was definitely a lot of lessons learned on the consulting side. I mean, we probably built and completed, you know, hundreds of types of like Salesforce integration projects over the years. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, there are like different, obviously like middleware tools that you can use to push and pull data out of Salesforce. But a lot of times what we found is that kind of could get you like 90% of the way to where you wanted to be. But then there'd be this like extra 10% that was like non-negotiable. And whenever that happened, we obviously would have to resort to some custom Apex, at least back in the day. And so we just got a lot of experience building, you know, custom integrations using Apex, came up with sort of our own like framework and design patterns for doing that. Tried to make those integrations that we built kind of as friendly to be able to change over time, you know, sometimes with like metadata mappings and different things. And at some point we were like, you know, there's no reason why this couldn't be a product, right? And that we couldn't like fully make this a point and click interface that any Salesforce admin could use to send and receive webhooks from Salesforce. So that was really the concept.
Cool. And just to give context to listeners, so where is your declared webhooks app right now in terms of revenue size or customer count, things like that?
Yeah, I mean, we have certainly like many hundreds of active users, a combination of like pay on our paid and free tier. In terms of revenue size, I mean, obviously we're looking to grow our revenue, but you know, I would say we're still kind of in the beginning phases of really launching this or growing the paid side of our so yeah, it's like super exciting. We've seen a lot of revenue growth over the last couple of years, and you know, as someone who's sort of transitioning from being on the consulting side to the product side, it's kind of been like a lot of incremental steady advances to kind of you know, really grow this into a full-fledged, you know, product. So it's pretty exciting.
Yeah. So kind of walking back to the early days. First off, I think I read that the Declared Webhooks first release was in 2021. Do I have that timeline right?
Yeah, that's about right.
Okay, so rolling back the clock to 2021, maybe late 2020, although nobody really wants to go back to 2020. But thinking back to those early days, did you build this out and kind of do some beta testing with the consulting clients? How did you go about like validating before you know, now you have hundreds of customers, but back then, was there anything you did to kind of make sure you're going to have product market fit?
Yeah, I mean, we kind of knew that there at least was like a solid concept here just because we had, you know, people had paid us money to build custom Apex around these use cases before. So if we could put a tool in their hands and save them money, then we knew that there was at least like some concept of product market fit. But in direct answer to your question, we had a client that agreed to be sort of like our first like beta testing users. And they were like, fully transparent with us. They were like, you know, okay, we'll use it. We can, you know, leverage it for this use case, but I'm like, we're making no commitments to like actually purchase anything and whatnot. And I was just excited that they had agreed to like literally be the first install of our product in an org. Mm-hmm. It actually worked out really great. And I think they didn't become a paid customer for a while, but I think about 6 months later, they did become paid. They did become a fully paid customer. And that was kind of, I mean, that was gravy for me, but it was very exciting to just get it installed, see someone kind of using your application in the wild. And then, yeah, obviously converting them into a paid customer was cool too.
That's so cool. Are they still a customer today?
Kind of. So the company was named Really. And unfortunately, they did go out of business, but the principal there actually moved to another company, and they're now using our product. So in a way, they're still using our product, but it's not in the same company. It's the same like end user person.
Well, okay. it's a nicer story maybe for on the Omnitorio side than for the Really side, but still, that's really cool.
Yeah. I think the main thing is like you're in service of companies, but you're also in service of people. So, you know, if you do a good job and they're happy with your product, you know, when they jump ship and, you know, go somewhere else, they remember you and, you know, they bring you along for the ride. So, you know, that's if we're talking about like product market fit, that's probably a good indicator also that these guys are still using us, you know, 4 years later, almost 5 years later. So
that's a really important point to make. I think a lot of people just stay focused on the logos, right? And thinking only about customers in terms of companies. But you know, people change jobs, companies go out of business, and then people are forced to change jobs. So making those great impressions early on really goes a long way. And unfortunately, you know, making those bad impressions can haunt you, I think, later on. So you mentioned the consulting business. Is the consulting business then, was it propping up in the early days while you're getting the revenue engine going for the application, or did you decide to fundraise?
No, we didn't decide to fundraise, and definitely having the consulting business was part of what allowed us to kind of build a team around building out this product as something we were sort of doing kind of on the side. And then I guess like in addition to that, in addition to just sort of having like you have your successful consulting team and you're able to sort of like port it over into, developing a product. I mean, obviously we had, you know, certain revenues, that we could, you know, in terms of like getting, you know, maybe some initial marketing efforts going and some of that stuff. It was definitely helpful. And then, you also have your consulting clients, right? So each of those is an opportunity to kind of put your product in their hands also. So, you know, like I was mentioning earlier, like our first customer was a consulting client. And that kind of helped us build like that initial credibility, I think, because we were able to, you know, sell, you know, five or six of our consulting clients on our tool and then, you know, collect some success stories and then, you know, kind of go to market with some of those success stories that, you know, maybe if we hadn't had a consulting business, would have been a little bit harder to find. So
sure. Yeah, I think it's the transitioning from consulting to kind of the ISV route, like you said, it can help get you some instant customers. But I also think that it can be challenging sometimes, because focus is so important. And, you know, you've got this revenue engine that's up and humming with the consulting firm, and now you're thinking about taking away time and dollars from that, investing into an application that you're not even sure it's going to work. And you're trying to sell, even though your consulting customers could be potential new clients, they might have their own initiatives that they'd rather you focus on. And so I'm sure in the early days, you sort of feel like you're cutting off your nose to spite your face, by pulling maybe some developers, and consultants off of active projects to focus on the declared webhooks app. Was that a challenge for you guys at all in the early days?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you're definitely, speaking particularly for myself, I mean, you're stealing, you know, time late at night, and there's a lot of pressures in the consulting business to like turn stuff around very quickly, and, you know, meet different deadlines, and, you know, clients are demanding. And one of the things that I've often said on the consulting side is like, demand for my time is like fundamentally like elastic, but my time is not elastic. Like, I have a finite amount of time in the day. So like, I might have one day where it's like, okay, today's not so bad. And then the next day, you know, I'm getting hit from 13 different angles that I had no idea. Like, I couldn't have planned for those things and those clients to reach out to me on that particular day. And then I'm completely, completely buried. So you're just, it's definitely like a struggle to sort of find the time. And also, you know, in the consulting business, like, there's sort of like a quantifiable understanding of like, this is what an hour of my time is worth. Right. So any time that you dedicate to other things, like, I mean, one way to look at that, or, you know, other resources on your team, is sort of a loss to the top line of the business in some sense. And even if you're sort of more favorably disposed to view it, and this is the way that I actually view it, is more of an investment of your time, it's a speculative investment. Like, you don't know, you know, is this going to be the thing that just sort of like blows up and, you know, we're all going to be, you know, making millions or tens of millions of dollars, or is this just going to be a waste of time, and, you know, people aren't really going to, you know, aren't really going to vibe my product, right? And aren't going to, or maybe even if they vibe it, maybe they won't buy it, right? They won't pay for it. So yeah, that's definitely like a risk and the concern. But on the positive side, you also have a much more scalable business. So in the same way that my time is not elastic, right? With a product business, right? You can essentially build the product once and sell it, you know, an infinite amount of time for no additional marginal costs, other than, you know, maybe like, oh, we have to have people who can respond to support tickets and that type of thing. But that's it's a type of business that scales like fundamentally, you know, any SaaS business really, like, just scales so much fundamentally better if you actually have a product that the market wants. So
sure, yeah, that, I think I heard once someone say the problem with consulting is I don't scale, which is exactly what you were saying, right? and you mentioned getting bombarded by requests some days, having light days other days, but you always get bombarded late on a Friday afternoon, right? Or like right when you're about to take a holiday.
That's, yeah,
the way that seems to go.
Definitely in the early days of consulting, when we had like a much smaller team, it felt like, yeah, there were vacations, but like there were no vacations, not really, you know, because you had clients and they had needs and they trust you, and you want to meet those needs, and you're sort of like under the presumption as a consultant that if you're not highly responsive to your client, then, you know, another consultant behind you, you know, will give them that level of care. So there's this constant sense of kind of having to sort of prove yourself and justify your value, and I've always kind of liked that, to be honest, like that feeling of like, oh yeah, I'm like in a new consulting gig and I have to prove myself, in the same way you have to prove yourself in a new job, let's say, but you have to do, you know, once every few years or 5 years or whatever. But as a consultant, you have to do that, you know, dozens of times, you know, per year. And that to me is like very exciting and fun. But it's also like very taxing and tiring. And, you know, there comes a point where it's like, you know, look, I just don't have enough hours in the day. I don't have more time. And, you know, yes, I can hire people and I can try to scale that way. But then even still, the scaling laws are linear to the number of people that you can hire and train and who can do a good job and your ability to effectively manage those people. It becomes a challenge to scale. Like, at least I found it to be a challenge to scale the consulting business, like past a certain point, unless I didn't really want to be a Salesforce developer, architect, or consultant anymore. I wanted to be like a people manager. And just knowing myself, like, that's not my talent. Like, I'm not I'm very good at building things on the Salesforce platform. I'm not necessarily like an exceptional people manager, you know, by any stretch of the imagination, nor do I really want to be. So then it sort of begs the question, like, why are you in the consulting business then? Because that's at some point, that's what you have to be, you know?
Sure. Yeah.
You're like a small team or something, you know, and that's your only ambition, which is fine too.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you said, you can, with consulting, you can grow, of course, you can hire more people, but I have yet to meet someone who found more than 24 hours in their day. You'll end up hitting the scale problem, right?
Yeah, no doubt.
Okay. So you had you had your first customer use it, and after it took 6 months or so, but they actually did become a paying customer. You had some usage from other consulting clients, it sounds like. Do you recall how long it took to get that first customer, that first unknown customer, you know, that first logo that was net new to the organization? You've never even interacted with them for consulting.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly how long, but it was definitely within like a couple of months of, you know, like maybe two. It could have been, you know, 1 to 3, somewhere between the range of like 1 to 3 months. Definitely before that customer became a paying customer, we acquired like our first like organic customer from the App Exchange. And it was pretty exciting because they were like a large real estate development company, I think in like Dubai or somewhere in the Middle East. So we were like meeting in the middle of the night about our product and their use case, and, you know, literally like at midnight my time or 1 a.m. My time to sort of go over what they needed. And and that was super. I remember that just being like a tremendously exciting opportunity.
I figured it would be. Yeah, I'm sure that's a very exciting time. So especially that use case, it's like all of a sudden you go from no customers, your first one is in a different country, you go global overnight. That's cool.
Yeah, exactly. And it wasn't just like another little tiny company. It was like a really significant, a very large real estate developer in the Middle East. So that was pretty cool. And, you know, like I said, very exciting. And I think it was part of, because I was mentioning before that, you know, that you can sell things to your consulting customers, but that doesn't necessarily like truly validate your product. I think much more so than that, when you get that validation that someone who didn't know you before, that kind of comes to you as like a product and as, you know, the list of features that someone can glean from the App Exchange, or like, okay, like I want that. I think that for me was like much stronger validation that we at least had like some degree of like product market fit than my ability to sell a product to people who already trust me as a consultant and who know who I am and who've worked successfully for many years. And then if they hear that, oh, you have a product that can solve my use case, they're like, they're all about it, right? They're happy to use it. But it doesn't really necessarily, it doesn't necessarily represent the market at large, I guess is my point.
Sure. Yes. I have spoken to other founders that started out transitioning from consulting to ISV and felt the same way, that, you know, they had a request from a client, which can be great because then you can get paid to build out your MVP, but that can lead to a false sense of product market fit, or like you get a false sense of security that you already have validation when really you haven't hit the market at large yet.
Yeah, for sure. And then, you know, also too, like in the back of your mind, and this is kind of like among the kind of interesting incentives that sometimes exist in consulting, like in the back of your mind, you're like, I'm selling a product where I could sell someone like, maybe custom Apex development. So I'm maybe accepting I'm generally accepting less money on a subscription, you know, product than I would on selling, you know, custom development time for the same the same use case. And I could just as easily have pushed them to one as the other. And of course, like, you know, or of course, like as consultants, like, you know, as an ethical consultant, like you always want to push someone to do the thing that makes the most amount of sense, right? That's the most, you know, scalable and maintainable and those types of solutions. But you have to give them some type of like value prop, right, in the product that you're selling them. So it does kind of maybe cannibalize, at least like early on, some of that, you know, potential like consulting revenue.
Yeah, that goes back to what we were talking about, right? We're feeling like you're cutting off your nose by your face a little bit, because that's a great point. You're taking it, if you're building out a product that could be consulting engagement, those early customers, you're taking a haircut on, and you're not really sure that that's going to be worth it in the long run.
Right. But, and you're very excited to like, I want to get my product in somebody's hands, right? You're very motivated to be like, yeah, I don't care, right? Like, yeah, I could sell a $10,000 consulting engagement or $15,000 consulting engagement, and instead I'm going to sell, you know, a SaaS product for, you know, $2,400, you know, for the year. And maybe even I'm going to offer to implement it for free because I just want someone using my product, right? So,
right.
But, you know, I think these are all, you know, you do also though, like learn a lot from implementing your product to a use case too. So it's like you install a product. So, you know, we were getting some like learnings out of it, but yeah, from a revenue standpoint, it wasn't necessarily like the best, you know, to convert consulting business to product business isn't always the best like financial decision.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any memories, some painful learning experiences you went through in the early days, like hitting some bugs, things like that when you were implementing early on?
Gosh, I mean, I just remember it like it was always sort of a race to kind of continue to add features. I think, not so much like bugs, but like we would hit roadblocks of, you know, discovering things that we couldn't do with our own product that we felt like, okay, like we have to be able to do that thing. And then also like a lot of like incremental advances. Like, for example, when we first started, we launched only supporting like the outbound use case only.
Mm-hmm.
Like, mm-hmm. we knew we were gonna have to support the inbound use case, because a lot of integration projects not only involve like sending data from Salesforce, but also like reacting to data from an external platform also. So it was kind of like racing to kind of add, you know, find these use cases, and then like adding, you know, continually like adding features and improving our product. I mean, yeah, like anything, you know, we have had issues where, you know, suddenly a bug has cropped up in our platform. Probably one of the most memorable one was so a portion of our inbound webhook service is actually hosted, you know, in Heroku, and we were having an issue where the Heroku server would just like suddenly like restart and like mess a bunch of things up. And so we had to figure out like solutions around that, so that, you know, we had like good backups and stuff like that. Cause it's much different when you're like serving, let's say, you know, a few thousand webhooks across, you know, a handful of people versus, I think today, you know, we're certainly, you know, in the, you know, tens of millions or hundreds of millions of webhooks per month that get sent, you know, through declarative webhooks. So a lot of that, like anything outbound happens native in the Salesforce org, but anything inbound kind of traverses a little bit of our infrastructure. So just having support and scaling that out, and then, you know, hitting some roadblocks around the, you know, along the way as things scale, and you realize like, okay, we don't really have enough infrastructure to support this, you know, and we have to have fast solutions to these things so that we don't bring our customers.
Well, especially with something as sacred as integration, right? I mean, you can get a lot of people can love and hate you really fast. I feel like when that thing goes down. So I can imagine that being a little bit scary when your Heroku server, or I think they call them dynos, right? Would go down and need to be restarted or whatever.
Exactly. And then, you know, Salesforce has also made some changes to like the guest site user over the years. So like, that's one of the reasons why we decided to stand up our own like Heroku server, you know, our Heroku dyno anyway, because there were so many limitations to the guest site user, and like Salesforce could restrict some of the permissions to the guest site user. And then all of a sudden, like a certain type of action that was working, you know, just fine, all of a sudden breaks, right? Because the security on the guest site user is sort of hobbled in some way. Yeah, I mean, you have to react to, you know, Salesforce platform changes, customer usage patterns and changes over time as you scale. And yeah, there's definitely a lot of things. And, you know, of course, there are sort of little bugs that sort of like crop up and, you know, we try to fix those sort of as quickly as possible. Most of those are have been pretty minor over the years.
Sure. Yeah. So, I love your application because, like I said earlier, I think everybody ends up needing to build this or has built this at some point. And I also think that it can be a great learning point for a lot of ISVs out there that are building in a space a little close to the native platform features. So I'm going to play devil's advocate for a minute, right?
For sure.
And think about maybe some early days, some possible pushback that you guys could be getting. You know, there were obviously, you know, the platform has evolved since then, but there's outbound messaging from workflow rules. There is technically the possibility to roll your own receiving endpoint with a REST enabled Apex class. I know that webhooks involve so much, you know, you mentioned some of the features earlier. I bet some of these came out over time. You mentioned the iterative development. I would imagine like retries is something you probably didn't have in V1, but you realize, oh, this is important because sometimes the other guy's server goes down and we got to be able to handle that, right? Just going back to my point, was this a problem did you have to convince folks that, look, yeah, some of this you can DIY if you want with Salesforce, but you're not going to really get what you need unless you have a full-fledged platform and solution like ours?
Yeah. So, I mean, like in terms of like the SOAP outbound messages, right? So like all of that's in XML. It's kind of was sort of too an older, at least at the time when we released, was too sort of a pretty old like integration standard. It's sort of
putting it nicely.
Yeah, it's sort of like fire. It's fire and forget, right? So you don't really know like what happened, how it was processed, you know, that type of thing. So it kind of like you could get something to work with outbound messages, but it was pretty limited and not that easy to use. I mean, it was easy to configure from the Salesforce standpoint, but it pushed a lot of the work outside of Salesforce for whoever was receiving the outbound message and then doing something with it. So it doesn't really like keep you in the Salesforce platform and doesn't keep the Salesforce team actually like doing a lot of the work themselves. In terms of like inbound, you know, just like, you know, creating your own like REST resource and all that stuff. I think in terms of that, it's not really, you know, of course you can do it. Like it would be like the standard way to do it on a kind of a custom basis with Apex, but you know, it's all code, right? So it's not fundamentally maintainable. If you have to add actions, if there's an API update and the webhooks change, you're now like having somebody who knows Apex to be able to like modify it and change it. So in no way is it like no code or like you know, maintainable with, you know, purely clicks by an admin. So yes, you could do it. But it's hard and maybe for very, very basic webhooks, someone could sort of like roll their own, even if they're not like super sophisticated with Apex, but for things that are like a little bit more complicated or require like more complex processing of some kind, it's like all of a sudden, you know, you're really turning this into a very like heavy, like code challenge. And, it's just not the smartest way to go. If you want to build a maintainable integration, I think is the idea. And actually where we've been getting like more, where we got kind of, pressure later on was more from HTTP callout in Flow, which kind of came along later. Because like I think I mentioned before that our first use case was basically the outbound use case, and like that's what it's with. And at the time, there was no ability to do that like natively in Salesforce at all. And then Salesforce came along and actually did it. And so that kind of forced us to think about like, well, where are the real value adds in the outbound use case? And, you know, in terms of that, it's like retry, logging, more complicated authentication, kind of delivering on more like enterprise integration features. And then on the other side, it's like, well, there's no real support for inbound webhooks at all. So let's double down on like the inbound use case. So it's kind of interesting that our product kind of started really like focused on outbound. And then I think at this point it's pivoted a little bit where like, I think outbound is, or inbound is our strongest use case, or more, maybe not our strongest, but our most like differentiated use case. And then of course, if you want to keep like a consolidate, you know, if you want to build like a full like integration solution, right, it's not just one way. Like you can't just be like, okay, I mean, you could, but you wouldn't necessarily want to say like, I want to send my callouts from HTTP callout and flow, but then I want to react to some, an invoice paid event in QuickBooks through declarative webhooks. It doesn't really make sense to keep those kind of separated, right? You kind of want one solution that does everything. So I think we have like certain advantages of being able to handle like both use cases.
Sure. Yeah. No. That makes total sense. And it's interesting that I was just curious if that was like a common pitch you had to make, and you had to often differentiate yourself from the native tools. It makes sense though that before the advent of HTTP callouts from Flow, people were on board with the outbound value, and then over time it switched to be more about the inbound.
So we've had to. I guess the point is really we have to answer that. I hear more about that now and having to answer that objection now, as opposed to in the early days when it was just like, you know, SOAP outbound messages or we could like roll some Apex to do it. And, you know, we weren't hearing very much of that at that time. So, and probably more commonly we'd hear stuff about like, oh, you know, can't we use, you know, Zapier for this or Workato or blah, 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 you know, and kind of competing as those other tools that are out there.
Were you often, you know, would you say that the Salesforce admin is basically your end user? Or consultants or developers, or maybe a combo?
I would say it's a combo. I mean, you have to in order to use our tools, like you have to understand what integrations are and kind of how they work. So if you're sort of approaching it as sort of a newer Salesforce admin who isn't really familiar with like, I don't know what an HTTP request is, and I don't know what JSON is, and I don't know what webhooks are, right? Mm-hmm. Not that person can't figure it out, but there's going to be like there would be a little bit of a learning curve. But a more advanced admin or someone who was like a consultant who understood like just basic like integration design patterns would like instantly kind of like get and grasp our tool. So I would say that's sort of like our ICP is like someone who's sort of like maybe just a little bit along their journey, who's done like some cross-platform stuff and understands like maybe basic mechanics of integration, but then understands the benefits of like, hey, like, we don't actually want to build this thing with code, right? Like I might know how, or I might have developers on my team who could do it if I asked them to do it, but that's not the right way to do it. Right.
So
in terms of like developers, I think there's like a good use case for using our app, even if you are a Salesforce developer, because we can handle like the configuration of the webhook itself. And then we actually have like a lot of Apex hooks. So you can like, invoke a declarative or like send a request that's configured in declarative webhooks from Apex, which I think is pretty cool. You can actually extend some of the mappings and the transformations through Apex. So we have like a lot of cool hooks for developers to be able to use, but who still want to have like a good portion of their integration work be like configurable. But I think you have to sort of overcome in the developer's mind who can actually build the thing fully in Apex, that's a value add. So it's a little bit of a case that you have to make, but I think it's a case that we can make. It's definitely a combo.
Are you struggling to make sense of the Salesforce Security Review? It's the number one roadblock slowing down your AppExchange launch. Security Review Partner translates those complex reports into a simple, prioritized checklist. Stop deciphering jargon and start shipping faster. Get the clear step-by-step guidance you need to pass the review with confidence. Simplify your path to market. Visit securityreviewpartner.com today. That's securityreviewpartner.com.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it's nice. I'm sure it's nice to not have to educate the client if they were like newer to the platform or newer to integrations in general. It's better to work with somebody who's a little further along, like you said, that would already understand some of the basic concepts in the alphabet soup. integration work.
One of my favorite, I wasn't necessarily expecting this in the very beginning, but I feel like a great sense of accomplishment when someone has installed our product from the App Exchange, and then we have certain feature parameters which allow us to see like the usage in our application, sort of like what stage people get to in the application. And like without talking to us, you know, if they can get something working and I can start to see like usage coming through, you know, with their integration without ever having talked to us, like that to me is like the best compliment in the world. And a lot of times, like we've literally had people who they weren't even responding to like follow-up emails, like, oh, hey, I saw that you installed our product, blah, 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 you know, left unread, you know, two or three emails. And then like a month later, their trial expires and be like, oh, you know, we really need to buy that thing. And, you know, they basically, not exactly like a traditional sales process where you're like constantly hounding someone, trying to get someone on the phone, but it's like they just installed your product, got it working, and then decided basically on their own accord to pay for it without ever like really having to sell anybody on anything.
Sure.
It's happened enough times that I'm like, I mean, that's part of why I think we have like a reasonable amount of product market fit, is because we've had so many people sort of go through that process without ever having spoken to us, and just boom, they're a customer basically.
Yeah. Well, that's one thing I think that's nice about your tech stack, right? Is that you mentioned you have the middleware running on the Heroku platform. So then you're able to see some more usage statistics. Folks can build out a usage framework kind of using like feature parameters, but it's not as nice. There are a lot more tools out there if you're running something on Heroku. And I wanted to ask a little bit about that. So was the decision to run on Heroku versus building the middleware out on like Lambda or some other serverless framework, was that intentional because Salesforce owns the Heroku platform, or can you take us back through the decision process there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just, it's probably, I mean, we definitely could have looked at other things just over the years, like working as a Salesforce SI and being involved in a bunch of sales cycles with like Salesforce account executives where they're maybe trying to sell Heroku to the end customer. And that's kind of like the tool that you have. We just had a lot of familiarity with Heroku. And then I think as a general proposition, like aligning with Salesforce as much as you can, I think is also just generally a good thing to do as a Salesforce partner. So we kind of wanted to just like stay in the Salesforce world and the Salesforce ecosystem in some way and not try to pull out of it. And just to clarify the Heroku, so Heroku just governs the inbound use cases, not the outbound use cases. And
gotcha. Okay.
Well, and the main reason we probably wouldn't have even done that, you have the ability actually to bypass Heroku entirely and not use it. But it requires you to either get our application working on a force.com site, which takes a little bit of configuration, and then limits you to the guest site user, which kind of limits some of the functionality and things that you can do because of some of the ways that Salesforce has locked down the Salesforce guest site user. And then outbound happens like totally, like that's really 100% native to Salesforce. And all of that usage, we do kind of have feature parameters that kind of count like how many callouts has people made, you know, did they, you know, how many tests have they made and that type of thing. And we use that to kind of build our understanding of who's using our product and, you know, who maybe just installed it and then just kind of like, you know, forgot about it basically.
Yeah, that's so cool. But even still, if it's just, even though you mentioned it's just on the inbound, not outbound, it's a nice story. I've always heard that when you're building on the Salesforce platform, it's better to have a narrative of like better together, right? And then so that you don't want to build something that competes with an add-on that Salesforce has built, because you're not going to get much love from the AEs and the SEs that way. But it sounds like as Declarative Webhooks grows, so would naturally your usage of your own Heroku instance, and therefore like Salesforce, obviously they're getting the rev share from your product, but also like everyone's just kind of winning together. I feel like that would be a good use case.
Yeah, for sure. And then that also has been kind of like one of the challenges to the product too, is because, you know, you do have like, you know, a Salesforce AE that might be waiting in the wings to sell like a juicy MuleSoft, you know, or something like that. And what we've always felt is that we kind of fit in like a nice middle ground between like maybe like a Zapier or something like that on the low end, and kind of maybe a more of an ESB style tool like MuleSoft on the high end, that there's sort of this like middle range. And so when we are in discussions with like Salesforce AEs about our product and its positioning, and, you know, there's sometimes when they might be trying to sell a deal and integrations are like a complete non-negotiable. Like, I need my Salesforce platform to like integrate with these three other tools. And then they mm-hmm. MuleSoft, and then the customer gets sticker shock. Like, that AE has to know, like, okay, well, what else, how else can we solve this use case and still like at least get this person like on the platform, right? And I think that's how we kind of position our tools. Like, yeah, you could sell MuleSoft, but then, you know, you might just like sticker shock the customer, and then they might bounce for HubSpot or something like that. So we definitely have tried to like build those like win-win relationships with Salesforce AEs, where like we don't try to like necessarily like compete against the MuleSofts of the world, right? We try to kind of find like a nice lane and a nice gap so that our app is kind of at least in the mix of conversations and can like maybe save a deal that the Salesforce AE would, you know, otherwise lose. So that's kind of how we work with them.
Sure, that makes sense. And would you say that a number of your deals are coming through Salesforce AEs or through the Salesforce team? Has that been a good lead gen source for you, or is it still mostly organically grown by you and your team?
I would say it's mostly organically grown. So I would say our biggest lead source is definitely like the app, probably the App Exchange itself is mm-hmm. good, is a very good lead source for us. Obviously our consulting business kind of does sell our product. So that's a decent kind of lead source in some sense for us. And then, I would say that the Salesforce AEs, like educating, some Salesforce AEs, it hasn't been like a big channel, but it does happen, with some frequency. And I think it's good, you know, you want to educate Salesforce and, you know, their solution engineers and their account executives on your product. And, you know, you never know, when that comes in handy. I would say like our consulting business is much more tied to the Salesforce AEs than our product business is. But they throw us, you know, a bone here and there from time to time also. So
sure. Yeah. Okay. I want to ask you a couple questions about some possible headwinds that perhaps y'all have faced. And I think because I think it could be valuable to some listeners. So your end user is often, like we talked about, admins, consultants, developers, but declarative webhooks are extremely important. Integrations are just, like you said, they're in that one deal you're talking about, like they're oftentimes just a must from the customer standpoint when they're working at Salesforce. But even still, it's not an application that makes the sales rep bring in more dollars and things like that. So my point is that your end user, I'm guessing, is not necessarily your buyer. A lot of Salesforce admins themselves don't have budget, or the Salesforce developers don't have the budget. They're needing to get approval from someone else, their manager or their manager's manager. Could you walk through, has that been a challenge for you, that your end user is not necessarily your buyer, or would you, how did you navigate that?
You know, it's a good question, because I mean, like, I think the closer you can get to sort of like the revenue generation engine, like of a company, I feel like the easier it is to make like very big claims about the impact of your product. Like, you know, companies who use our product experience, you know, 10x growth in their revenue or something ridiculous like that. Like, I think as kind of a tool or more of a utility on the Salesforce platform, like we can't make those kind of like really big monstrous claims. Like, we can make claims that like, hey, if you install our product and you build integrations with it, you know, you're going to be able to implement your integrations, you know, in, you know, I don't know, 30% of the time at half the cost or whatever the case may be. Like, you know, it's more of like a product, it's more of a productivity enhancer from the perspective of the Salesforce team, and also like a more of a reduction of cost. So there's definitely some limits in terms of what kind of like dramatic claims we can make to the market, if that makes sense. But to be honest, I think a lot of the users of our product, especially like the organic ones, like they tend to be part of like maybe like in at large organizations, but part of like small, scrappy, you know, Salesforce teams where it's like, you know, the director of, you know, it's like a technical kind of director of revenue ops who's like, he technically like controls the budget, but he's also like doing a lot of things like on the Salesforce platform. So I don't think we've gotten much pushback where it's like the end user themselves is having like trouble like allocating budget or making making the case. But it is true that we're not necessarily like talking to like the CEO or the CFO, like of a company, and like making a sales pitch directly to them. It's sort of more at the maybe like the director of RevOps level, you know? And I think that probably does, like, it would be better in some ways if we could make that like more of a sexy business case, if you will, to like the CEO of a company or something like that, you know?
Because
they won't necessarily understand art. They want to hear like the business side of it, and they might not get the tool as well. You know, I think as to your point, like a Salesforce admin would get our tool, or Salesforce consultant would get our tool.
Sure. I mean, I can understand that. You're essentially providing the electrical outlet, you know, that everybody needs to get anything working. You got to be able to integrate with this third party platform that you love so much, right? But sometimes sometimes it can be a little bit more challenging to convince that the buyer of that. But when you're not so close to the revenue engine, like you were saying, that you can point to this is the impact, even though it's absolutely necessary to get that impact from that other tool to be able to hook it up. So,
but it has also been like, as we're considering like building other things and other products, it's one of the things that I've thought about more is like developing a tool that's more geared towards an industry vertical or something along that can kind of bring people more to the Salesforce platform, where you could make a much stronger case to Salesforce AEs about why they want to loop you into a deal, right? Because maybe it's not something that Salesforce natively supports, and you're basically helping, you're giving people like an on-ramp onto the platform itself. Like that's something that a Salesforce AE would be much more interested in paying attention to, certainly like within specific industry verticals. And then also where you're dealing with more like specific like business leaders, and you're able to like more directly like engage and sell them and kind of get their intention, their attention directly, you know, by making more of a business case, I guess.
No, that makes total sense. And that's actually, it's funny because that's exactly what my next question was. I was curious if this has been in the headwind for you guys, that you're such an important, vital, horizontal product that everybody needs. And sometimes that, I know that can be a challenge on the marketing side, because you're not hyper-focused on one particular vertical or one particular industry, and so then it can be difficult to land your messaging sometimes with your ICP. Has that been a challenge for you guys, or have you found a niche that, for whatever reason, even though you could work in any industry, you know, this particular industry seems to really prefer using declarative web hooks?
Yeah, I mean, one of the areas that's kind of surprised me, and there's definitely like a decent cluster, is like solar companies and like solar contractors. There's a lot of them, because it's a very, it turns out it's a very like integration, like heavy space, because there's all these different tools. Like there's like APIs, which tell you like how much energy usage like a home has. And then there's different parts of a solar system where like you can like, they have like API endpoints that you can interact with that gives that solar contractor like intelligence about maybe their existing customer base and like other products that they could sell them, or also like just like sizing a solar system for on behalf of a customer, like not making them, oh, can you print out your utility bills or email your utility bills? They can just plug directly into their utility and like pull that data and then start building their or like right sizing the solar install that's necessary for those customers. So we have found like a little bit of a niche there in different areas. And we're constantly kind of looking for those. Like, what are the opportunities, like even within an integration where it's like, you know, good luck finding a Zap for integrating with, you know, PG&E or something like that. Like, you're not going to find it. So that kind of gives you like a little bit of a gate and a little bit of a moat. And then you kind of flex that muscle and build that expertise. And, you know, you find yourself in a pretty strong position, because then the next person who comes along is like, oh yeah, we've done this like five times, you know, and here's how you do it. And, you know, here's the services, you know, and we've got, you know, templates that you can just like plug and play and, you know, and go for it. So, but yeah, you have to be on the lookout for those opportunities. And in the case of the solar one, it was very organic. Like we didn't necessarily go looking for it. It sort of us, and then we've sort of, you know, try to take as much advantage of that as we can.
You just started seeing a lot of traffic on AppExchange from those types of customers. You realized this might be a vertical you should double down on.
Yeah, and then you see the same, you know, a few of the same tools and the same like that they keep using over and over again. So you realize like, hey, this is a good, you know, this is a good little like a rich little niche that we can kind of you know, leverage and use. Yeah, I think it's definitely, I would say like, it's definitely important. Like in the early days, I didn't really understand this idea of like, we have to focus on a niche, because it's like, our product can do anything. Right. And that's like the temptation is, especially someone like me, who's maybe like a little bit more technical. It's like, I want to focus on solving as many things as I can. I don't want to like limit myself, but it's much harder when you go to market with a product that's completely, you know, you know, it's like, we can do anything is not a marketable message, really, you know?
No, in fact, oftentimes it's a negative rather than a positive, even though I've talked with folks on the show before, how developers building on the platform, building managed packages, it's like ingrained in us to look out for any landmines that would handcuff us to a particular feature or a particular product on the platform. Because we want to make sure that anyone and everyone can install the app. And then sometimes that translates into the marketing, but that's where it kind of falls flat. Technically, it's great to work anywhere and everywhere. But when it comes to positioning, it oftentimes helps to have a really, really niche focus.
Yeah. And I think we've sort of found similar things like in the financial services industry too. There's a lot of like very complicated tools. You know, just being able to serve those tools and say like, hey, like, we can integrate with them. And especially ones that tend to be like more like proprietary, they don't necessarily even like publish a public API, but you've done enough integrations of them that like you have everything like ready to go for someone to get started on them. So, yeah, just really looking for those opportunities. But I think we have done it like very organically. Like we wanted to see what do people need and what do people want? And then we've sort of like tried to double down on just the things that we see as they've developed organically. I don't know if that's the best way to do it. Like maybe we could have benefited earlier on from being like trying to sort of laser focus on, you know, on a niche. But by the same token, you know, how sure are you that you're right about that? So it's kind of nice to also just kind of let's collect some data and some information and see what the market is actually, you know, telling us it's interested in.
Sure. Well, speaking of the market telling you about its interest, I also wanted to ask you a little bit about your pricing. So you have a freemium usage-based model, right, that I saw on the AppExchange. Is that what you launched with? Is that a model you grew into? Did your pricing change at all over time?
Yeah. So originally, Originally, we started off with just like basic tiers, kind of like a, you know, a basic, kind of a middle tier and a premium tier. And that was all based upon like mostly like an annual, you know, an annual or monthly amount with certain usage limits. I think what we thought over time was, especially on the lowest tier, that was creating a little bit of a barrier in terms of getting people like into our product. So we wanted to kind of lower that barrier as much as possible. So the first thing that we did was we tried to create like our lowest tier where it's like a small monthly amount with like a relatively high usage charge, basically. The idea being we're trying to like get people into the product as cheaply as possible. If they don't need to use our product for that many calls, then it ends up being like a very like inexpensive tool, but it also creates some pressure to kind of graduate them to the higher tiers. That was kind of like our pricing strategy. And when Salesforce released HTTP Call and Flow, we realized that, all right, like that's kind of going to take a little of the steam out. So we have to give away like some of our product for free, right? So that people can get into our product and can use it on some level, and decide that it's actually like the better tool, for them. So we launched the freemium later, and then, yeah, I think that's sort of been the evolution. As we started off with like basically just three tiers with certain usage caps, we created a usage tier, and then later we added the freemium, because, you know, we just want people using our tool. And we were actually finding it wasn't enough. Like we give people like an unlimited sandbox trials. Like you can use our product in sandbox for as long as you want. We don't, we want people to like get into our product and love our product and use our product. And we think the best way to do that is, you know, for people to build whatever they want in a sandbox, first, make sure that we're the right tool for them. But I don't think that was like resonating enough with the market. And I think it definitely did help us to give like a freemium version of our product away for free. And of course you sort of get that indicator on the Salesforce App Exchange itself, which is kind of allows people kind of, I think, draws people in a little bit to the possibility of just at least playing with your product, you know?
Sure. So I'm a big fan of the freemium model. I, you know, there are some folks working in the B2B space that don't love freemium because they say, well, you end up having your paid clients need to subsidize those free users. But that's in general B2B SaaS companies. Whereas when you're a partner on Salesforce, one thing that's nice, I mean, I know you all have the Heroku instance, but first of all, you mentioned that if you really wanted, they could bypass it, but also that's only inbound. With the freemium model on Salesforce, I mean, everything's running on Salesforce infrastructure. So that whole kind of downside of freemium sort of falls by the wayside because you're no longer having to subsidize for the free users. The free users are just running on the same CPU instance or the same CPU that they would have before with their Salesforce origin.
Yeah, there's no like infrastructure costs, right? To like, I mean, it's all on the Salesforce side, what the customer already has. So there's no significant disincentive. And it is true, like us with a little bit of our infrastructure potentially outside of it, maybe there is a little bit of that, but I don't really view it as that much of a disincentive, to be honest. I think I'm a big believer in, I really want people to use my product, right? And I think if they use it, they'll like it, and if they like it, they'll buy it. So I don't want to create really any barrier to someone coming to that realization that I think that they would come to. And so I know that there's arguments against, there's certainly like arguments against it, but in my mind, I think the benefits outweigh the costs by a lot.
Oh, I'm with you. I think that scarcity mindset is actually can end up hindering folks. And I feel like what you just described is kind of that flywheel effect where you want to bring people in because you're proud of what you've built and you know that they're going to like it. And then they do like it. And then they want to stay and become customers. And then that allows you to fund more growth and more feature development so that people will even more want to use it. But so that's great. Well, so I've taken up a lot of your time, so we should wrap up here.
Yeah, for sure.
I do want to ask, you know, if you were going back to giving advice to maybe yourself when you were starting out in the ecosystem, or to maybe today to another a wannabe ISV founder, is there anything you've learned from growing out Declarative Webhooks that you'd like to pass on that wisdom to?
I think if I could go back in time and tell myself something, I would have started building products much sooner in like my exposure to the Salesforce platform. I was very focused as a consultant, you know, on the consulting side, as basically like a Salesforce developer and architect for a long time. And I could kind of see like, doing a product might be fun, but it was kind of like it was very unknown to me. It was at the time. And so I kind of like, I don't know, like I just won't really, you know, I don't really have time to focus on this right now, but I think if I had to go back, it would have made a lot of sense. Like I the same product we built in 2021, I probably had a good idea. I, 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 I probably thought about on some level in like 2017. And I feel like if I had released, honestly, like if I had released it in 2017, it would have been much farther ahead of its time in that. And there would have been far less competition in that period of time. And sometimes it's just like, you just got to, you know, if you have a good idea or if you have an idea that you believe in, you just need to start. Right. And you just really go for it.
Adam, I love that. I love that. There's maybe you've heard this before. There's a Chinese proverb, the best time to plant a tree was 30 years ago. The second best time is right now.
Yeah, exactly. So I would just say, like, if you have a good idea, like, don't be afraid of it and just jump in, try, you know, the worst you can do is to fail. Right. And, there's a lot of people out there who, you know, have done it before and, you know, I'm sure like would be willing to like give people tips and help and that type of thing. And, yeah, it's, and having gone through it too, I think I'd sort of built it up as something that was really maybe harder than I thought it was. Right. And it really wasn't, I mean, it took time and it took effort and it took all of those things, but I created barriers for my, you know, barriers and reasons not to do it that I don't think were actually real, you know?
Sure.
So, yeah. And it's been a great ride, you know? So.
Yeah. Well, I'm enjoying tuning in to seeing where the ride takes you from here on. But for anyone that wants to learn more about you, the company, or see about getting a trial of declarative webhooks, so where can they go to get more information?
Sure. So you can visit our website, omnitoria.io, or of course, you know, look us up on the App Exchange and, you know, take us for a test drive, install us in a sandbox for free for as long as you want. Of course, we have our freemium version, which you can also install in production. So.
All right, Adam. Well, thank you so much. Looking forward to the days ahead, and I'll talk soon.
All right. Sounds good, Scott. Talk to you soon.
Cheers. Bye.
Building an App Exchange business can be isolating. Are you tired of guessing what the right next move is to grow and scale? Don't go it alone. ISV Forge surrounds you with a curated group of fellow ISV founders who are on the same journey. We combine peer accountability with expert-led weekly webinars to help you overcome roadblocks and build a thriving business. Stop guessing and start scaling. Apply for the next cohort today at isvforge.com. That's isvforge.com.